Okay, I want to start by wishing David a happy birthday. I don't have any stories that wouldn't be too embarrassing, but I think I speak for all of us when I say it's been a pleasure and a privilege to be your colleague. You've had an amazing 30-year run, and I hope there's another 30 years that, or I wish you another 30 years even better than the last. Okay, so I'm going to talk about flux brains. I'll explain what they are. And this is going to be partly a review of prior works that other people have done, and also it's a discussion of some work in progress with Michael Gutperl. It's a little early for me to be talking on this, but it's always more fun to talk about what you're working on rather than the last thing you did, so I hope you'll bear with me when some things are a little incomplete. So what is a flux brain? So in 3+1 dimensions, various kinds of systems have magnetic monopoles where one surrounds a point-like object with a two-sphere, integrates F over it, and gets the magnetic charge. Or alternately, there can be magnetic flux tubes where instead of surrounding the object, one has a flux tube, or what I'll call an F1 brain, where one takes the transverse two-dimensional space, integrates over that, F over that, and gets some non-zero charge. So in D dimensions, I'm going to be interested in D equals 10, an FP brain is something which has P+1 dimensional Poincaré invariance along the world volume. And we take the remaining dimensions transverse to the world volume and integrate either some field strength F or higher rank form F or its dual in the transverse plane and get some charge for this brain. Now, these kinds of things exist for all P and string theory, though in some cases the charge spreads out and becomes infinite. And there are also generalizations of this where, for example, instead of integrating F, one integrates F wedge F, and one can also generalize this to M theory. So I want to argue that these are an interesting family of, in general, non-supersymmetric solutions of M theory and string theory that we should try to understand. So let me start out by explaining the classic example of the kind of thing I want to discuss. It was discovered, the so-called Melvin universe, which was discovered in 64 by, is Mel here, or he lives in Santa Barbara now and is often seen at seminars, but I guess he's not here right now. So this is a solution of four-dimensional Einstein-Maxwell gravity. And it looks like, here's the metric. And here's the field strength. Lambda is this function which grows linearly from the core of the flux brain. You can see from here that it's got the symmetry is, first of all, 1+1 dimensional Poincaré invariance along the flux tube. And then there's a U1 symmetry of rotations about the core of the flux tube. And if you take the total B, this quantity B here can be thought of as the strength of the magnetic field at the origin of the flux brain. But somewhat surprisingly, the total flux is finite. And the reason that the total flux is finite is that the stress energy of the electromagnetic field causes the space to close up, kind of an onion-like configuration, far away from the core of the flux brain, and so the total flux can be finite. You might refer to this as confinement of magnetic flux by gravity, though both electric and magnetic flux are confined in this sense, because there's another solution where we simply dualize F, which would be, I guess, an electric flux tube instead of a magnetic flux tube. Now, this can be embedded in string theory, for example, in a string compactification with the simplest way would be to take a string compactification with no vector multiplets, and then exactly this solution would be a solution in some string compactification to four dimensions. But let me move to higher dimensions. So there's something in the 2A theory, the so-called 2A F7 brain, which involves the Ramon-Ramon two-form field strength of the 2A theory. And here one has, it's like a dilatonic Melvin universe, because the dilaton will couple to the field strength and can't just be set to zero. And one finds that the dilaton, the field strength, will act as a source for the dilaton. And one finds that the dilaton grows at infinity, but it can be made arbitrarily weak at the origin, so we can have an arbitrarily large region in which string perturbation theory is valid, though inevitably we will always have a region very far from the origin where strong coupling will occur. Something like in the NS5 brain, where by making the coupling weak at infinity, we could have a long, weakly coupled region in the throat, though ultimately the coupling always goes to infinity. And these were discovered a long time ago by Gibbons and Maeda. And I've set G string and M string 1 here just to keep the formulas not too cluttered. Now, these things really start to get intriguing, or at least what really intrigued me, when you take this 2A solution in 10 dimensions and try to lift it up to M theory. So there should be some M theory interpretation of this. And this was worked out quite a while ago here at Santa Barbara. And it turns out that when you combine all this gauge field and dilaton that you have in this dilatonic F7 brain, that the 10-dimensional the 11-dimensional picture is just flat 11-dimensional space. But what makes it an F7 brain is that when you go from 11 dimensions to 10 dimensions by periodically identifying x11 with period 2 pi r, you accompany that with a shift through an angle RB. So you identify and then you twist in two of the space-time dimensions that you're going down to. And what happens when you do that, this is a little challenging to draw this here, but here would be R equals zero. And since we're doing this rotation when we identify, the M theory circle is getting dragged along further and further by this rotation as we move further out from the origin. So the theory is getting more and more strongly coupled as we move away from the origin. Okay, now why is this interesting? I think this is a very striking observation. It's been made even more interesting by sort of interpretation in a recent paper of Gutperl and Costa. So let's think about this from the 2A point of view. From the 2A point of view, we turn on a magnetic field. We've broken the 10-dimensional Lorentz invariance down to an 8-dimensional Lorentz invariance. We make that stronger and stronger. Finally, we reach some critical field strength of order 1 over the string coupling. And then there's some crazy change of variables involving non-perturbative states with interchanging with perturbative states. And in terms of the new set of variables, we're back to the 2A theory. So, of course, this will have two dual descriptions. One will be as a 2A theory, the 2A vacuum with a very strong magnetic field, and the other will be as just the flat 2A vacuum. So it's surprising because we've of course gotten a lot of mileage by discussing the various ways in which one can interpolate between the various supersymmetric vacua of M theory. But now we have an interpolation which not only violates the Lorentz invariance of the vacua, but it violates supersymmetry, yet it achieves this interpolation in a very beautiful way. Now, even more interesting is this critical value that I've written at the top here corresponds to a rotation in the M theory picture by 4 pi. If we're rotating only by 2 pi, we don't quite get back to where we started from, because the fermions will then all have a minus sign when we go around the M theory circle. So a 2A theory or an F7 brain with magnetic field 1 over G rather than 2 over G is like M theory on S1 with a minus sign for all the fermions. And it's been argued by Bergman and Gabriel that M theory on S1 with a minus sign for the fermions is equivalent to the 0A, which is one of the non-supersymmetric tachyonic string theories. And I think this, so this would be a duality between 2A with one value of the magnetic field and 0A with another value of the magnetic field. Now, of course, this is a conjecture about a duality. I haven't really proven anything because we had to go to very large magnetic field strengths, and there's nothing is BPS protected here. So anything could happen. But nevertheless, I think it's a very beautiful story, which all pieces of it hang together in a coherent way. And it's certainly worth pursuing to see what we can do with it. It also, there's been a lot of recent interest in tachyon condensation of various kinds. And this also gives a very nice picture of the fate of the 0A tachyon. Because if we think in terms of the dual description of 0A theory as 2A theory with a strong magnetic field, that magnetic field can decay by an analog of Schwinger pair production, and the thing will decay back down to the 2A vacuum. And so that's suggesting that the 0A tachyon condensation takes you back to the 2A theory. Now, I'm sorry, what time did I start and what?
We have 15 minutes.
I have 15 minutes, okay. Now, this duality between 0A and 2A can be thought of as an SL2Z transformation in defining our choice of what we call the M theory circle. So if we start out with X11 over R as our M theory circle, and phi is our angular coordinate in the plane that the magnetic field sits in, if we do this SL2Z transformation, as I've written here, that amounts to including an extra 2 pi rotation in our M theory identification, and including that extra 2 pi rotation is equivalent to putting a minus sign on the fermions. So it's equivalent to going into the 0A picture. Now, so we of course could consider other kinds. It's interesting to, we've got now a torus. We can think of a torus, X11 and phi. And it's interesting to consider what other we could do any kind of SL2Z transformation on that torus and get a new choice of an M theory circle and a new description, a new dual description of this theory. And I've written one special choice here. And if we do this particular SL2Z transformation that I've written here, we in fact end up in 10 dimensions with flat space. But it's not quite flat everywhere. There's a conical singularity at the origin because of this funny prefactor I have in front of the angular coordinate, which I'm calling phi hat, after the SL2Z transformation. And the string coupling gets rescaled by a factor of n to the 3 halves when I do this. But this tells us about a duality between this F7 brain and the 2A theory on a flat cone where I've got a ZN identification. Now, we didn't really understand 2A theory on a flat cone, though if we can get this for arbitrary angles, it could be relevant to what Steve Schenker was bringing up the other day of trying to understand near horizon strings stuck near the horizon of a black hole in terms of string theory on a space with an arbitrary deficit angle. Okay, but now we can do something a little different. We can consider now a compactification where we accompany the shift in going from 11 to 10 dimensions by a rotation in a four-dimensional subspace, which sits in an SU2 left subgroup of the O4 rotation group. So I now have two planes and two angles, phi1 and phi2, and I rotate both of them by the common angle BR when I do the identification of from 11 to 10 dimensions in M theory. And what I get then will be supersymmetric because there are some spinners which are invariant under these SU2 left rotations. And so I get a supersymmetric F5 brain now because I've done something in four of the dimensions. And it will have a charge, a non-zero integral of F wedge F. And now I can ask the same, try to do the same thing I did before, which is to do some modular transformation on the torus parameterized by the sum of these two angles and the M theory circle and get a dual representation of this. And by doing that duality, if I choose my magnetic field so that it's B, magnetic field of the origin times the radius of the M theory circle is 1 over an integer, then I can do an SL2Z transformation which transforms this supersymmetric F5 brain to a 2A theory with an ALE singularity, a more conventional kind of string background. And obviously this can be generalized to higher kinds of brains with higher powers of F and larger holonomy groups. Okay, so what about the other FP brains? Well, when I first started thinking about this, I did a search through the literature, and there's so many supergravity solutions out there, I assume that these must have been written down somewhere. But I'm pretty convinced now they're not written down somewhere, though somebody correct me if I'm wrong. And the reason is that they aren't written down is that you have to find them numerically. And none of us remember how to do anything numerically. So, that's why I've written this tentative here, because we have to do this calculation numerically. And while we can only find these solutions numerically, they're not supersymmetric, so it's not simple to integrate the equations. We can take the solution, start at the origin, and then match on to some analytic solution at large radius. So I think that we can understand the analytic behavior of the solutions at large radius. And here's tentatively what we think the result looks like. Now, the first thing to notice here, or just to make it more familiar, is that this is just like the near horizon solutions for the FP brains. The difference is the power of R that appears in front here and the powers of R that is appearing here. Well, that's one difference. The other important difference, of course, is that in the case of the P brains, one writes an analytic solution like this, which extends all the way to R equals 0, where there's typically a singularity, except for the 3 brain. But here, the solution is not valid at R equals 0, and rather, numerically, one attaches it on to something which is completely smooth at the origin. And also, like the P brains, these are weakly coupled at infinity as P gets small. And similar solutions exist for M theory. And also an important point is that for P less than 7, the total integral of the flux, unlike the case I described, is divergent. So there's a smooth flux spread over the whole space. So now I'd like to pose a question, which I'm not going to answer, but I think it's an interesting question. So there's a very pretty story for what happens with this 2A F7 brain. And now there's a whole family of these flux brains for all P in 2A and 2B string theory and in M theory. Is the 2A F7 the only one that is part of a beautiful duality story, or is there some kind of web of dualities that we haven't understood yet involving these other F brains? So first question that one might ask is whether they're periodic. So the 2A F7 is periodic in the field strength. What about the 2B F6? One might conjecture that the 2B F6 at some critical coupling would become the 0B theory, just as the 2A F7 becomes the 0A theory. And you might think that you could just demonstrate something like that by T-duality, and T-duality suggests that something like this should be true. But strictly speaking, if you just act with T-duality on these solutions, you don't get the maximally symmetric kind of flux brain solutions that I wrote down. Rather, you get smeared flux brains. And so T-duality implies that smeared flux brains are periodic in their field strengths. But one would like to know whether the flux brains themselves are periodic. Now, I found one little piece of evidence that one of the other flux brains was periodic. And to explain that, I'd like to talk about how these flux brains decay. So we're all familiar with how a magnetic field or an electric field in 4 dimensions can decay by Schwinger pair production of point charged point particles, which are then accelerated off to infinity. Less familiar, but known, is this paper Dauker, Gauntlet, Gibbs, and Horowitz, in which they showed that in general flux brains can decay by nucleations of spherical brains of various kinds. Now, naively, you'd think that the stronger the field, the faster the decay rate. But the decay rate was computed, and surprisingly, it was found that when you get to this critical value of the magnetic field, there are nonlinear corrections, it's not just the Schwinger calculation, when you get to this critical value of the magnetic field, the instanton action goes to infinity, and the decay rate goes to zero. Now we can understand that as evidence that secretly there was some new variables in which supersymmetry was restored. Well, something like this also happens in the four-dimensional Melvin universe. We can't understand that as some kind of rotation. There's no dilaton there. It's a rather different animal. But we can compute the decay rate, and the decay comes from pair production of magnetically charged black holes. And that was calculated some time ago by Garfinkel and myself. And we found that, again, at a critical value, B equals 2 over G, the decay rate goes to zero, basically because you're trying to pair create these black holes and their horizons touch, and then you can't pull them apart. So the fact that the instanton action diverges at this point, again, is at least consistent with the idea that there's some kind of periodicity, or at least some new stable vacuum being reached at these very high field strengths. Okay, finally, I'm just near the end of my time, but I want to pose what's an obvious question, and that is, what is the holographic duals of these theories? Or do they have a holographic dual? Well, I'm not going to tell you the answer, but I'll make some comments. First of all, it should be a non-supersymmetric theory, presumably a gauge theory. So perhaps this is an arena in which we can learn something about duals for non-supersymmetric string theories. And if we look at the form of the metric back here, it's just like the DP brains in that the coefficient of G00 is going to infinity at R equals infinity, and therefore we'd expect that R equals infinity is the ultraviolet, and so that's consistent with the idea that there's some kind of brain that sits, dual brain that can sit at the boundary of these spaces. And in fact, in this way of writing the metric, it's clear that scaling R can be compensated for by a scale in the p plus 1 remaining coordinates, so R may even be, the radius may even correspond to energy. Also, the fact that it's weakly coupled at infinity for small p is consistent with the idea that it's some kind of field theory. But what field theory? Well, one candidate is that these are some kind of duals to the non-BPS D brains, which, like these flux brains, exist only for odd P in 2A and even P in 2B. Another possibility is there's a critical scaling theory in which one turns on a magnetic, some kind of form field strength, and there's a critical bubble, unstable but critical bubble, which is held open by the balance of the tension and the field strength. and there's a scaling limit in which one holds the radius of such a bubble fixed and takes the string scale to infinity. Now, I'm not going to talk about either of these proposals in detail because they have problems, but let me conclude here by just saying we have a few enticing facts about these flux brains. A lot remains unknown, and I think they're potentially fertile ground for advancing our knowledge of non-supersymmetric string theory. Yes.
So in the far future, this is not a great ground state.
Right.
How do you think of the dual field in a situation like that? Can you repeat the question?
Well, we could also say that we could have... Oh. He said that these objects have tachyons, and therefore in the far future, they decay. In principle, one can have a duality where both objects are unstable. And indeed, all my candidate dual things had instabilities. Now, that of course makes it harder to, you know, you've got to find the duality before the thing decays. So that certainly is an obstacle to understanding these dualities, and one of course could have said the same thing about the 0A duality with the 2A, but my view is that the picture is holding together well enough that we should be exploring it and seeing what we can do with it. Because the field which measures the energy, she said, how could it be that the 0A can decay to the 2A because they both have zero energy, and once the 2A, 0A starts losing energy, how can it get down to the 2A? That answer, if you accept everything that I've said and don't worry about dualities decaying before you can find them and so on, that question has a definite answer in this framework. And the answer is that the notion of energy as defined by 2A is not the same as the notion of energy as defined by the 0A. The metric, or whatever it is, the Hamiltonian of the 0A, is not the same as the 2A Hamiltonian. All the fields, or most of the fields, are mixed up in this transformation of variables that takes you from 0A to 2A. Well, but it's a different Poincaré invariance. So first, the way to think of it is start with the 0A. The Poincaré invariance acts very differently on the fields. Start with the 0A, which is Poincaré invariant. Then think of its dual description as 2A with a very large magnetic field. Once you go to that dual description, there's no more Poincaré invariance. Now that magnetic field decays back to the 2A vacuum, and that corresponds, and now you've got 2A Poincaré invariance, but that 2A Poincaré invariance is something very different than the Poincaré invariance in the 0A theory. Why shouldn't it be? It certainly, I mean, once the tachyon starts rolling, it has to break Poincaré invariance. Now, why it should be, And whether we, why it should be broken exactly the way it is something that's more.
Yeah, the mapping is very rooted in infinity, right? I mean, infinity plus great is.
The mapping is very weird at infinity, and between and a state which is a state which is if here's r equals infinity. Whoops. Sorry. Here's r equals infinity. A state which is a string state which corresponds to a membrane wound like this in the zero-A theory is a state which is corresponds to, in the two-A theory, is a state which is, you know, doing something crazy, winding way around the circle at infinity. So the transformation between the variables of the zero-A and the two-A theory is very strange. Yeah.
So the thing that bothers me about this is really the second side of the duality, lots of great literature. There seems to be quite a standard and sensible description of what's going on. You have this excited state of the two-way vacuum gaze by filtering. And now you're saying it's dual to this other crazy thing, and I don't see what physics of the zero-A theory we're ever going to see in the real physics of this situation. What's really going to happen is well described in the flux frame picture as the decay of the flux frame by Gifford.
It's not well described in the flux brain. I mean, it sounds good, but it's not as good as it sounds because the magnetic field is of order 1 over G. So it's not a weakly coupled description. The real weakly coupled description of what's going on there would be in the zero-A theory. The usual story when you have a duality. That
okay, but the zero-A theory, the weakly coupled description doesn't really make any sense.
Yeah. You mean it eventually you run it, sure. Eventually you run into the region which is halfway in between 0A and 2A and nobody can help you. But there's a picture here of how it all fits together. That the time coordinates are the same.
So there's a Hamiltonian. It's supposed to be the same Hamiltonian on both sides. If you say yes, then I'll ask you this question.
I don't know in what sense the Hamiltonian is the same on both sides.
Okay, let's see. One more question from Igor, and then we'll break.
Comment. I believe there is another interpolation between type 0A and type 2A along the circle of navigation that was discussed, I think, by Venus and Blum. And they also, I think, found that you start with type 0A and the trolls start with type 2A because they calculated the vacuum energy as a function of radio.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me mention that, let me just say briefly what that is. There's a well-known perturbatively understood duality between 2A on a theory with twisted fermion boundary conditions and 0A on a theory with the minus 1 to the F right. Not F right plus F left, just minus 1 to the F right going. So the T-duality takes you in between these things. And a lot of the argument that Bergman and Gabardiel used and Gutperl and Costa used involved this well-understood perturbative duality, and then doing a 9-10, this 9-10 flip where you reinterpret this as an M-theory circle, and that's what led them to this picture of the relationship between M-theory on a circle with twisted boundary conditions. And so it's all very consistent. Everything I've said is very consistent with that business. In fact, that's where it really came from.
Okay, why don't we try Andy?